annual Henry Charles Lea Lecture, commemorating the life and work of America's first great medieval historian, just a few steps from his great library, which is on the other side of that door, which will stay closed. The speakers who don't need an introduction are the ones who always get it, and this is the case today. Dr. Jonathan Riley Smith, Dixie Professor of Ecclesiastical History Emeritus at Cambridge University, and possessor of many other titles, which I will not list, once said of himself, "I began my career with the study of a military order, and then moved in the late 1960s and early 70s to the political and constitutional history of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. In the mid-70s, my interest turned to the theory of crusading, which involved me in theology and canon law, and the role of popes as teachers. This led to a concern with the responses of laymen and women to ideas of crusading. I have now returned to the history of the military orders, I would guess much better informed than he was when he started out." And these were not simply fields of interest. These included books like The Knights of St. John in Jerusalem and Cyprus in 1967, The Oxford Illustrated History of the Crusades, The First Crusaders, the first collection of literally a prosopography of everybody who we can trace who went on the crusade, and The First Crusade and the Idea of Crusading, a book much honored here because it was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Professor Riley Smith is not only a great and widely published scholar, he is also a producer of students. In fact, he owns crusade history in the English language. And he is also a contender in popular arenas, which are utterly pointless, but dedicated scholars are nonetheless compelled to engage in them. And he has given his smacks to the Kingdom of Heaven and other preposterous notions of crusade in the 20th century. This will not be his subject today, when he will speak of some modern approaches to the history of crusades. Jonathan. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that. I'm very flattered and honored to have been asked to give this lecture. Of the five topics I intend to discuss, four are or have been controversial. They are the form taken by the Western settlement in the Levant that followed the conquest of the Crusaders, the ethos of the military orders, the nature of Crusades, and the motivation of Crusaders. The fifth, the role of Crusade ideas in the 19th century, is only now coming into focus. The topics are related in the sense that with respect to the first four of them, traditions which have prevailed for nearly two centuries and originated in the writings of Sir Walter Scott and Joseph François Michaud are being challenged. You might think it's about time. And it was Scott and Michaud who set the scene for the exploitation of Crusade ideas and imagery and images in the 19th century. Between 1819 and 1831, Scott published four novels in which Crusaders played significant parts. For him, a child of the Enlightenment who'd been influenced by the Scottish philosopher-historian William Robertson, the Crusades were the incursions of glamorous but uneducated Westerners, childish and destructive, into a civilization superior to their own. For Michaud, whose Histoire des Croisades appeared between 1812 and 1822, and for those writers who followed him, the Crusades were glorious instruments of nationalism and proto-imperialism. These visions of the past must have seemed to be irreconcilable. Indeed, the only matter on which there appeared to be agreement was that a crusade was defined by its opposition to Islam. But they began to merge with one another in the 1920s, when crusading, stripped of its ethic, was being interpreted in social and economic terms by liberal economic historians who took for granted that crusading was an early example of colonialism. Scott's image of representatives of an inferior culture barging their way into a more sophisticated one coalesced with the Michaudist conviction that their motivation had been proto-colonialist, and the amalgam gave birth to the neo-imperialistic and materialistic orthodoxy, which was expressed until fairly recently in influential academic works such as Stephen Runciman's History of the Crusades, and is still a feature of popular perceptions. Ed Peters referred to the film The Kingdom of Heaven, which is pure Walter Scott, absolutely pure Walter Scott. Now, the first of the topics I intend to discuss, this settlement in the Levant. The nature of the Latin settlement in the Levant became the subject of debate at a time, the 1950s, when European empires were being wound up. Of the two leading revisionists, Joshua Prava, an Israeli, has recently been portrayed as a leader of the reaction against colonialism. One should add that he'd settled when relatively young in British Palestine, where he'd in fact absorbed British imperialist ideas at the same time as he reacted against them. The other revisionist, the Frenchman Jean Richard, was a pupil of René Grousset and stands at the end of the great line of French historians descending from Michaud. From different perspectives, therefore, but with roots in imperialism, Prava and Richard rewrote the history of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, demonstrating that the ossified feudal state portrayed in its 13th century law books did not accord with the reality of the 12th century, nor it transpired later with that of the 13th century either, and they provided it with a coherent, rather Stubbsian model of constitutional development, although their approach has given way to a more fractured view introduced by the grassroots studies of Stephen Tibble and Hans Meyer. Prava and Richard, however, differed in their perception of the relationship between conquerors and conquered. Prava, together with the English historian R.C. Smail, who was my supervisor, assumed that the settlers had lived out their lives segregated from the indigenous inhabitants of Palestine. Prava and Smail ferociously attacked the belief introduced a century before by Emmanuel Rey and still held by Jean Richard that there had developed in the Levant a Franco-Syrian society in which semi-orientalized Westerners mingled with the indigenous to produce something culturally unique. To Smail, on the other hand, the settlers were a ruling class separated from their subjects by language and religion, with force as the ultimate sanction of Frankish dominion. Prava went further, using the word apartheid to describe the way the settlers, gathered for the most part in urban communities, were segregated from the population in the countryside. This division of opinion was, of course, one within the imperialist tradition. Since the 19th century French conception of a Franco-Syrian society reflected, as Smail recognized, the goal of cultural integration on French terms, which featured in French empire building, while the segregation posited by Prava and Smail echoed, in their cases subconsciously, the distance that British administrators tended to keep between themselves and their indigenous subjects. The belief that the settlers were isolated from the indigenous could not, however, survive advances in archaeology and the subsequent rereading of the historical material. Ronnie Ellenbloom's treatment of colonial settlements, Yaroslav Folder's works on Crusader art, and Dennis Pringle's monumental survey of the churches in the Kingdom of Jerusalem are contributing in different ways to a revival of the image of a Franco-Syrian society. It's now clear that the settlers were not isolated in the towns, while evidence is growing for cultural synthesis and even for pockets of religious syncretism. The new approach does not, of course, as some of its adherents suppose, mark a departure from the post-imperialist image of a Western colonial society overlaying an indigenous substructure. It is, in fact, the revival of the French version of it. But an interesting feature of it is that it is now divorced, almost utterly divorced from the issue of proto-colonialism, which was such a source of argument and was so important to historians like Prava. The question whether the Kingdom of Jerusalem fitted any colonial model is now hardly ever mentioned. historians of the Latin East seem to be no longer very interested in it. This uncoupling of interpretations generated by imperial experience from the more general ideas that used to fuel interest in them is the first of several oddities in Crusade historiography to which I'll draw attention. It follows the abandonment of Marxism in the wake of the collapse of the communist experiment, and also a transformation in thinking in Israel, the centre of much of the work on the settlements, where a new generation of historians and archaeologists are treating the achievements of the Western settlers in the Central Middle Ages very positively. Very positively. Ronnie Ellenbloom traces a progression from a, I'm now quoting from his from his most recent book, from the Jewish reading of Crusader history, focusing on the slaughter of the Rhineland Jewish communities in 1096, to a Zionist reading of the Crusades, focusing on seeing them as an inverse prefiguration of the future Zionist movement, and finally, to the reading of the Crusades as part of my own country, and to a certain degree as part of my history. I actually delivered a lecture in Jerusalem 3 weeks ago, large part of which was dedicated to this particular issue of the transformation of the image of crusading in the eyes of the Jews, who you'd think above all from the persecutions that accompanied the Crusades to the East, you would have thought that this was the most unlikely thing to happen, and the vast majority of my audience agreed with me that it had happened. The challenge these younger historians pose to existing preconceptions about the history of Palestinian settlement and land use has a political dimension in Israel, but there can be little doubt that it has a wider relevance, because treating the settlers far more empathetically than before, it's clearly linked to other developments in Crusade history, which I'll describe. When neo-imperialistic materialism was fashionable, it was rare for the military orders, the second of these topics, to be treated as religious institutions. Studies tended to concentrate on their military and political activities in the East, or on their institutional history as great corporations, or on their economic role as landlords and even as bankers. But with the renewed interest in ideology and motivation, to which I will turn later, several historians are researching their ethos, recognizing that they, the military orders, were the products of the same movement to reform the religious life, which gave birth to Cistercians, Carthusians, Premonstratensians, Augustinians, Franciscans, Dominicans, and Carmelites. The church reformers of the Central Middle Ages were acutely aware of the sinfulness which they perceived to be encompassing them. In one response, the battle against sin was to be a private one, fought in an enclosed and contemplative environment. In the other, prayer was to precede a public confrontation with sin, either through pastoral care and works of mercy, or through the bearing of arms, which was believed to be an expression of Christian charity. The perception that love could be shown as much in the use of force as in medicine or nursing was demonstrated in the transformation of the Hospital of St. John, an already existing religious institute devoted to the care of the sick poor, into a military order, although the process was a painful one, far more painful, I now know, far more painful than I thought when I first wrote about them in the 60s. After what now appears to have been a traumatic internal struggle, which extended over at least 15 years, the brothers of the hospital, who'd taken the first very radical steps towards militarization within 6 years of the foundation of the Templars, came to terms with their dual function of caring sympathetically for pilgrims to Jerusalem, including Muslims who were admitted to their hospital, and defending their Christian brothers and sisters with armed force. And in so doing, they set precedents for other military orders with dual functions, such as St. Mary of the Germans and the Sword Brothers. The lives of the professed in the military orders never lost its religious dimension. Underlying and justifying their existence was a philosophy which is often ignored, is now attracting some interest, but still has to be thoroughly researched. The earliest of the texts on the subject, the so-called Hugo Peccator letter and St. Bernard's De Laude Novae Militiae, are well known. But more attention is beginning to be paid to the sermons of James of Vitry and others, to liturgy and hagiography, and to other works by the brothers themselves and their employees, such as those written by the Templar of Tyre, William di Santo Stefano, Peter of Duisburg, William Caorsan, Giacomo Bobozio, Sabo di Castiglione, and many others. Although it's not easy to penetrate the interior lives of the brothers, and in some cases sisters, because they were hospitaller nuns, a distinctive ethos is being identified. The penitential nature of crusading provided St. Thomas Aquinas with a justification of the role of the military orders when he wrote about them in his Summa. To make war, he wrote, in the service of God is imposed on some as a penance, as is evident from those who were enjoined to fight in aid of the Holy Land. But the brothers of the military orders were not crusaders, as we'll see. Chivalric ideas were possibly exerting some influence on them from the late 12th century, but any influence was limited, although the Teutonic Knights pandered to the tastes of European nobles and employed extravagant theatre to attract them to their risen. The prevailing mood, in fact, remained penitential. Austerity was a dominant feature of the brothers' lives. It was visually expressed in the unshaven faces of the Templars. It's striking how often, in the accounts of the interrogations of them after they'd been arrested for blasphemy in 1307, to find references to brothers who'd shaved off their beards to mark their abandonment of the order. Austerity also expressed itself in the simplicity of the buildings of the military orders. The architecture favoured by the hospitallers on Rhodes, which they occupied as an order state from the early 14th century to the early 16th, the architecture favoured by them, ignoring the anachronistic vulgarity of the fascist reconstruction of the Grand Master's palace, has clean lines, the bareness occasionally broken by mouldings over windows and doorways. The chief decorative feature is a profusion of coats of arms. Splendour was rejected in favour of a severe, almost puritanical minimalism, identified with nobility and expressing itself in prowess and charity. The message seems to have been that the brothers were the embodiments of the ancient Roman virtues of piety and nobility, an idea which was already influencing a treatise on law and his order, written by the learned hospitaller knight William di Santo Stefano in the early 1290s, and which pervades a little book of advice to a nephew who had also entered the Order of St. John of Jerusalem, composed in the 1540s by another hospitaller knight, Fra Saba di Castiglione. Architecture may also provide clues to changes in the ethos of the military orders. The exuberant Renaissance flamboyance which transformed the simple lines of Tomar in Portugal into a kind of fairy castle must reflect the fact that the Order of Christ was being secularized and was becoming rich from its management of the Portuguese Empire. The architecture of the Knights Hospitaller on Malta, which they ruled from 1530 to 1798, was originally as austere as it had been on Rhodes. But in the 17th century, decorative fantasies, the work above all of Matteo Preti, began to soften the simple lines and cover the bare walls of the interior of their conventual church in Valletta, while the armorial tradition was carried to extremes in the carpeting of the floor with armigerous mosaic memorials. When the Auberge of Castile in Valletta was rebuilt in florid Baroque in the 18th century, the brother knights, however able and interesting some of them were as individuals, may already have been subconsciously reflecting the reality that their old role was becoming anachronistic. What was a crusade? That question became controversial after the Second World War. In a post-war, Cold War society, the interest of which in the justice or otherwise of violence was fueled by reports of the Nuremberg trials and by debates about nuclear deterrence and proportionality. Although few historians can be neatly pigeonholed, it's now customary, as many here will know, to categorize those trying to define crusading as either generalists who believe that the term crusade should be applied to any warfare on God's behalf, or I did not invent these terms myself, I hasten to say, or popularists who propose that the essence of crusading lay in a prophetic, eschatological, collective movement among the peasantry and urban proletariat, or traditionalists who treat as authentic only those expeditions launched for the recovery of Jerusalem or in its defence, or pluralists who maintain that authentic crusades were fought on many different fronts. More recently, motivation, as opposed to definition, motivation, which involves the spectrum of goals, hopes, beliefs and fears that first impelled people to take the cross and later sustained them while they were on crusade, has become a topic for discussion. Although everyone agrees that crusading responded to changes in fashion, that the aspirations of recruits were never uniform, and that the intentions of individuals were often mixed, those scholars interested in motivation can be divided crudely into the camps of materialists and, this is my phrase, sentient empathists. That last phrase represents an admittedly clumsy attempt on my part to come up with a descriptive title which encompasses the sensations and emotions as well as the ideas of the men and women we are trying to understand. Sentient empathy answers to a feeling that materialism, the long-held belief that the crusaders to the East were in general motivated by profit, was in need of revision. Materialism had been born out of 19th century imperialism as it was reformed by economic historians, more by liberals than by Marxists, because Marxists seem never to have been very interested in the Crusades. Specialists on the subject have played no part in materialism's development, and no one has even half proved it by research. Norman Housley has pointed out that convincing studies even of the role of the Italian merchant cities have yet to be written. Materialism seems to have gained currency without any research, I say, without ever being properly researched, seems to have gained currency among Crusade historians only in the 1950s. When in the vanguard were the Israelis, particularly, again, Joshua Prawer, for whom the portrayal of the Crusaders as proto-colonialists was in accord with his intensely felt Zionism, his intensely felt Zionist perception of the history of the Promised Land since the diaspora. I've already pointed out that interest in the application of colonial models to the Latin East has waned. But the preservation in Christian hands of the Kingdom of Jerusalem and the other Levantine settlements required, of course, the exploitation of land and commerce, and many, although not all, the colonists were settled in standard colonial fashion. The occupation of the Baltic seaboard by the Germans, Danes and Swedes had colonial features, and in the Mediterranean there were byproducts of the movement such as Venetian Crete and Genoese Chios, which fit into a kind of colonial mould. Associations with early imperialism are also to be found in the journeys of exploration, patronised by the Portuguese and Spanish kings 200 years later, which opened Asia and America to Europeans, because they had as their purpose a crusading one, to find a way round the back of Islam, to attack it from the rear, and to loosen its stranglehold on Asiatic trade. A general economic history of the Crusades in every theatre of war, which also takes into account estate management by the military orders and the activities of European merchants, is very badly needed. But the fact remains, beyond all that, the fact remains that no compelling case based on evidence for the prevalence of the profit motive among crusaders to the East has ever been made. I'm going to concentrate on the pluralists with regard to definition and the sentient empathists with regard to motivation, because I've been involved with them. Envisaging the waging of crusades not only in the East, but also in other theatres of war, pluralism aims to provide a model for identifying a crusade by concentrating on the legalities which defined its status and that of a crusader. Proclamation by the Pope on Christ's behalf, including an explicit association with the liberation of Jerusalem or the Holy Land, even when the target was elsewhere, and vows of a special kind made by the fighters, who enjoyed in consequence certain temporal and spiritual privileges, particularly the indulgence, were believed to be representing Christendom as a whole, rather than any particular nation or community, and wore crosses. Sentient empathy is harder to define. It has similarities to an approach in sociocultural anthropology called cultural relativity, in which scholars suspend their own ethnocentric or political predispositions and study a subject with reference to its culture rather than to their own. Sentient empathy avoids ethical judgmentalism and takes what people wrote about themselves and about others seriously, not at face value, because that would involve interposing our perceptions, but in relation to the world in which they lived. It is, therefore, the antithesis of pluralism. Pluralism is a model, since it abhors models, although both approaches lead to an interest in recruitment, and it's possible to hold to them simultaneously. I can say that for a fact, since I do, because pluralism is relevant only to what might be called macro history. Sentient empathy has been applied to the ideas and behaviour of crusaders on the march, but most of its practitioners have concentrated on motivation. We are confronted by men and women living hundreds of years ago who were engaged, often spontaneously, in an intense and self-absorbing and uncomfortable and dangerous and cruel activity. The emotional penumbra which enveloped every crusade from the recruiting assemblies onwards was heightened by chivalric display, apprehension and fear, and by the devotional practices, fasts, processions, the solemn liturgical round which punctuated the march. The agitated state of mind of many crusaders is revealed in their visions of the saints and of the ghosts of their own dead. Since it is quite impossible for us to get into their heads, one of our only entry ports into their thought world is through the collective consciousness of closely knit groups, so long as they were not overstructured or too closely controlled, which is why families have been receiving some attention. But the temptation to put one's own assumptions into the minds of others still remains, and can only be mitigated by applying rigorously to every case a knowledge of the technicalities and formulae which everyone at the time was in a position to comprehend, as full an investigation as possible into the context in which people took the cross, and a recognition of the triggers that would galvanize them into action. This means bearing in mind not only obvious religious, political, and socio-economic factors, but also many other much more intangible ones which make up the mental spaces that people themselves inhabited, in the words of Marcus Bull. They include memory and memorialization. And I've just come from a conference in New York, organized by a pupil of mine on memory and memorialization. It's of course a sentient empathist conference. They include memory and memorialization, and what Dr. Bull has called the underlying assumptions and instincts, which up to then may not have found any dedicated outlet, but could now assume a central importance. Pluralism and sentient empathy are not particularly original. Works in the quite distant past have taken a line which would be later identified with pluralism. Sentient empathy echoes developments in other fields of history in which faith is now taken more seriously than it was comparatively recently, and in other disciplines, such as literature, social anthropology, and psychology. It was foreshadowed by the concern for mentalité, which has been a feature of recent medieval historiography. But that approach, I mean the mentalité approach, which stresses the need to study imaginative conceptions such as friendship and enmity, work, childhood, death, irrationality, and sexuality, is defined by topic rather than by method. It would be hard to discuss any of the mentalité topics, of course, without touching on the senses, but a characteristic of mentalité is the use of models, which those engaged in sentient empathy seek to avoid. Pluralism and sentient empathy are Eurocentric. Since, as Giles Constable has remarked, the pluralists ask how a crusade was initiated and organised, they are naturally driven back to the West. These advocates of sentient empathy also spend much of their time delving about in the European grassroots. By widening the canvas to include campaigns in Europe as well as in the Levant, and by lengthening it to take in the early modern period, pluralism has vastly increased the range of source material the historian must read, while the nature of sentient empathy requires a consideration of everything which might be even tangentially relevant, including texts of all kinds, literary as well as historical, and images, artifacts, and architecture. Caches of material, which were previously ignored, are now seen to have a direct bearing, even for what was often thought to be the overworked 12th and 13th centuries. On the other hand, a scrupulous adherence to the evidence in such a vast range of sources can lead, without careful planning, to projects that are overambitious and uncritical. Pluralism and sentient empathy are also characterized by the degree to which their advocates have been prepared to argue out their case publicly. Their opponents, on the other hand, have tended to express their opinions in private and rarely in print. A striking feature of almost all past writing on the Crusades, of course, has been the avoidance of, one might almost say an escape from, any discussion of definition or method. And even the histories of the authors of the large-scale general histories, Grousset, Runciman, and the American team led by Kenneth Seton, did not trouble to justify their approaches to the subject. It's also the case that most of those who've spoken out are English, accustomed to a political and legal environment which is adversary. At any rate, the responses to pluralism and sentient empathy have been muffled. James Brundage has recently pointed out that the adherence to other viewpoints than pluralism seem not to have been moved to produce a similar, coherent and systematic theoretical justification for their approach to the subject. Exceptions, in terms of speaking out, though not in coherence or system, are Ernst-Dieter Hale and now, although his argument takes a different course, Paul Shevardin, who've argued for generalism, Christopher Tyman, who wrote the first critique of pluralism and used to maintain that all descriptions of crusading are merely the products of the environment in which they arise, although he now seems to have abandoned that position in favour of conventional pluralism, and Jean Flory, who's tried to revive traditionalism, although after discussing the alternatives, his argument degenerates into a series of rather boldly stated assertions. It's nevertheless true, as Brundage went on to write, that the vast majority of the critics of pluralism have, I'm quoting now, confined themselves to describing their approach in a few sentences, or else left it to their readers to deduce the premises on which they stand. And this is a stark contrast to the seriousness of the challenge to the ground on which many of them do stand, because the pluralists reject the belief that crusading is defined by its theatres of operation in the Levant and its hostility towards Islam. It's something much bigger than that, crusading, I mean. Smale and Prava were fiercely opposed to pluralism towards the end of their lives. Smale was the kindest and most decent of men, and as I said earlier, he was my supervisor. But our relations in the last few years of his life were definitely affected by my pluralism. Prava yelled at me for 20 minutes. I know what his views were. But they never went into print. Some historians, like Hans Meyer, have resorted to a brief emotional outburst, or, like Jean Richard, have apparently agreed with pluralism while constructing a case which tacitly argues for the other side. Much the same is to be found when one turns to sentient empathy, about which one often hears of doubts being expressed sotto voce, and against which contrary views tend to be asserted without engagement in any debate. Although there are plenty of features of pluralism and sentient empathy which could provide avenues down which a critical assault could be launched, the incoherence of their opponents has given the impression that they're built on deeper foundations than they really are. And one is faced with the extraordinary consequence that the most convincing arguments against pluralism are nowadays being presented from within the ranks of the pluralists themselves. Pluralism, after all, is a model which is primarily based on canon law and the mature formulae expressed in 13th century documents. It was born in the closing years of an era in which models were fashionable. And like all models, it breaks down when one turns from the general to the particular. Since I myself wrote the model, I can say this for certain. I thought I really had solved the world when 30-something years ago I produced this. Of course I hadn't, and the weaknesses became all too apparent. Giles Constable, Norman Housley and I have drawn attention to the way the criteria pluralism employs can lead to the exclusion of certain types of activity which in reality cannot be ignored. The application of pluralism into the 12th century, when crusading was undeveloped, has still to be fully justified. While it holds good for crusades to the east, at least after 1198, and for the defence of Europe against the Turks from the late 14th century onwards, for some of the campaigns fought in the Iberian Peninsula, in Prussia and Livonia, and on the Finnish-Russian border, for crusades against the Cathars, Hussites and Mongols, and for those against the opponents of the Church and its allies in Italy, it cannot be adapted to encompass other essential elements. The Brothers of the Military Orders were never technically crusaders, since as professed religious permanently engaged in the defence of Christendom, they did not take crusade vows. The secular lords and knights of Latin Palestine and Syria were not crusaders either, and the campaigns they fought in defence of their homes and properties were not usually crusades. The leagues formed to combat the Turks from the 14th to the late 17th centuries were not crusades in the strict sense, because although they were provided with papal authorization and had participants who'd taken vows and were granted indulgences, they were built out of alliances of independent Christian powers, even when support of them was preached outside the borders of the Allied states, and so lacked the supranational ethos which was characteristic of crusading. But these manifestations were all so closely associated that it would be absurd to treat them separately, and the only answer for a pluralist like myself has been to consider them as expressions of a movement which comprised more than the Crusades as strictly defined. The weaknesses in sentient empathy have yet to be fully exposed, but its practitioners are open to the criticism that they are moving onto ground far more perilous than that occupied by anthropologists, who are generally concerned with surviving, if alien, cultures. Another potential weakness is the danger, when using psychological insights or those evolved by specialists in literature, of adopting the models employed by writers in those fields, Marcus Bull and Norman Housley have drawn attention to recent failures in the application of psychohistory to the Middle Ages. The writing of interpretative history is an ephemeral activity. Theories and approaches, however fashionable for a time, invariably become dated because the practice of history has to involve a reconciliation of the past with the present, and the present is in perpetual motion. In the end, what matters, however, is not the worth of any intellectual method, but whether it's impelled scholars towards new discoveries and perhaps into new fields of study. In spite of their obvious defects, pluralism and sentient empathy have encouraged real advances in the subject. Pluralism has opened up a vast panorama of time and space. Although there'd been some interest in later crusading, and Kenneth Seton had been drawing attention to the wealth of archival material to be found for it up to the end of the 17th century, the authors of general histories, written or planned until quite recently, had tended to give very little space to crusades after 1291, and none at all to those after 1464. It is now quite common for many of the maritime and land campaigns against the Turks in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries to be described in terms of crusading, and for the contribution the movement made to the formation of overseas empires, particularly that of Portugal, to be reassessed. Indeed, the 16th and 17th century manifestations of crusading can now be judged to have been the most successful of all. In the pluralist perspective, moreover, the theatre of war in the East now competes with the Iberian Peninsula, the interior of Western Europe, the Baltic region, Greece and the Aegean, the Balkans and North Africa. An impetus has naturally been given to studies of developments in these regions, and they've benefited from examination by historians experienced in crusade studies, while comparisons between the Iberian Peninsula and the Levant, or between the order states of Prussia and Rhodes, can be made within an intellectually coherent framework. Pluralism has provided a more satisfactory, because better sourced, way into the studies of the poor than ever before. Gary Dixon, the author of a brilliant new book on the Children's Crusade, and usually regarded as a generalist, acknowledges its influence on him, while Norman Housley has drawn our attention to the most successful and least known mass movement in the entire history of the Crusades, the revival of peasant armies in the 15th century. A more general consequence is that the Muslims have lost some of their significance. Now jostling for attention with pagan Wends, Bolts and Lithuanians, shamanist Mongols, Orthodox Russians and Greeks, Cathar and Hussite heretics, and Catholic political opponents of the papacy, they've moved slightly off centre stage at precisely the moment when the general public, bombarded by Islamist propaganda and confronted for the first time by the Islamist concept of crusaderism, have had their views of the movement as something specifically anti-Islamic reinforced. Sentient empathy has contributed to a growing interest in the history of families and other social networks in relation not only to the kindreds in which crusaders were concentrated, but also to those of the settlers. Research on motivation is no longer based on speculation, but on evidence. And the pressures and support brought to bear on individuals by kindred and local nexuses of lordship are clarified. Although it's slightly unfair to say so, since they make only fleeting appearances in Georges Duby's famous study of the Mâconnais, a telling comparison can be made between Duby's materialistic treatment of crusaders, in which evidence, more or less non-existent, is sacrificed to theory and educated guesses, and Marcus Bull's examination of the background to the responses to the preaching of the First Crusade in Western France, in which a more evidence-based and nuanced interrelationship between land, family interests, customary attachments, and religion is described. Sentient empathy has encouraged studies of the military orders as religious institutes, as we've seen, and it's led to a greater use of literature, vernacular or Latin, prose or verse, as a historical source, and to research on crusade sermons, which Penny Cole and Christoph Meyer have been exploiting to provide very revealing evidence. My final topic is in a different category. Although its significance might never have occurred to us, had it not been for the expansion of crusade history into early modern times, a body of 19th and 20th century material, which has barely been considered and has not yet been fully analysed and interpreted, is coming into view because Elizabeth Sibury, in pioneering works similar to those of Kenneth Seton on the 16th and 17th centuries, has drawn attention to it. She seems to have considered it to be, on the whole, an interesting example of romantic memorialization. But I am beginning to wonder whether we're not faced by something more important than that. We can now see that the 19th century generated clouds of pseudo-crusading rhetoric, some para-crusading activity, and at least one authentic expression of the crusade movement. Pseudo-crusading rhetoric, which originated with Michaud, can be defined as the hyperbolic use of crusade language, particularly in relation to imperialist adventures in Algeria, Morocco, the Levant, and Indochina, which had nothing at all to do with the old reality of crusading. Para-crusading, on the other hand, contained within it some elements of the old movement, although they were chosen selectively and were distorted. The most striking and in the long run most influential para-crusading enterprise involved the re-emergence in England of a military order in a different guise. In the 1820s, French Knights of the Order of Malta, that is the old hospital of St. John of Jerusalem, which of course had ruled Malta, because that was why it's taken that name. French Knights of the Order of Malta, which was in a state of anarchy following the loss of the island, entered into an alliance with a faction in the Greek rebellion against the Turks, with the aim of sending military support to the uprising in return for the island of Rhodes, which the hospitals had lost in 1522. Attempts were made to raise funds on the London market and to equip an English mercenary naval expedition which would sail to the Mediterranean. Financial subscribers and officers commissioned in the force could become members of the Order of Malta. The project had no consequences whatever in the Eastern Mediterranean, but it entailed Protestants being admitted to a Catholic religious order to carry war to the Turks. Although disowned by the headquarters of the Order of Malta in Italy, it led to the emergence of the most venerable Order of St. John, which spread throughout the world later in the century as an instrument of British empire building, paralleling the efforts of the Portuguese military orders in the 15th and 16th centuries. The case of authentic crusading was the brainchild of Charles Marshal Allemand Lavigerie, Archbishop of Algiers. In 1879, gravely concerned by the danger Catholic missionaries faced in Africa, and certain that the spread of Christianity was being hindered by the flourishing slave trade there, he suggested that it might be possible to restore, under a new form, elements of the old military orders of chivalry, which rendered such great service to the church in barbarous times and in similar circumstances. 5 years later, he proposed that the Order of Malta should revert to its military role and establish an order state in eastern Central Africa, basically in what is now the Eastern Congo. It was all going to be on the west bank of Lake Tanganyika. When he could not persuade the Order of Malta to do so, he planned to set up a military order of his own And in 1890, he founded the Religious and Military Institute of the Armed Brothers of the Sahara. And there they are. Crosses and guns, as you see. The Armed Brothers were to establish centres to which escaped slaves could have recourse. They were expected to live severe and demanding lives of devotion and apostolic charity, of work, self-denial, prayer, zeal and sanctity, sleeping and eating in the African manner. They made vows to be obedient to their superiors, to be poor, to be chaste, that was the three ordinary monastic vows, and to fight to death if it should be necessary for the defence and protection of those, principally the victims of slavery, who will put themselves under this institute's protection. They had therefore to carry arms and know how to use them, and in each settlement they had to build a redoubt and keep an arsenal of weapons. Le Vigier's professed fighting religious were not unlike those to be found in the 13th century Baltic region, where crusades were being fought in defence of missions. Although his order was clearly anachronistic, established only two settlements, and was closed down after 2 years, hundreds of men applied to join, and 95 were accepted. This is a photograph taken at the mother house at Biskra in southern Algeria, on the edge of the Algerian desert, in the spring of 1891. And there is the community at Biskra with the novice master, who's one of the White Fathers, the Missionary Order of White Fathers. I'll say a bit about that in a minute, in the centre. He specified particularly what they were to wear. This is their kind of habit, with the crosses on it, and you can see that they're armed. Le Vigier was not some utopian dreamer. He was a major figure in the process of reconciling the Catholic Church in France to the Republic and in its defence against anti-clerical onslaught. He was close to the popes and was elevated to the cardinalate in 1882. One of the greatest figures in the late 19th century missionary field, he was certainly regarded as such in Protestant Britain as well as on the continent. He also founded the successful missionary orders of the White Fathers and the White Sisters, which exist today. His crusade plans attracted a respectable measure of support from many people, including Pope Leo XIII. In his interests and political influence, Le Vigier reminds one, although obviously on a lesser scale, of the 12th century Cistercian abbot Bernard of Clairvaux. The short biography of Pope Leo XIII, in the third edition of the Oxford Dictionary of the Christian Church, describes how the Pope tried to bring the church to terms with modern civilization, and the lead he gave on the burning political and social issues of the time, but it contains no reference to the letters of privilege he issued in 1879 and 1888, extolling the Knights of Malta for their glorious service on behalf of Christianity and the Catholic faith, and for the victories won by them against the enemy of the Christian name. That's a sentence that could have been written by Innocent III, Gregory X, whoever. Cardinal Le Vigier's entry praises this passionate and far-sighted man for his commitment to the Africans and his foundation of the White Fathers and White Sisters, but is silent about his obsession with crusading. Three of my grandparents were alive, when Le Vigier closed down his military order in 1892. He closed it within a week of his death. He was in fact dying. The French government was putting pressure on him. They were extremely worried about this establishment of a military order. If he'd lived, perhaps he would have continued. Anyway, we appear to have completely forgotten, to have completely wiped from our minds, how recently crusade ideas, whether authentic or associated with para or pseudo-crusading, were attracting the interest of significant individuals. It's natural for someone like myself, approaching the 19th century from the direction of the Middle Ages, to see crusading casting a long shadow, but it may well be that the initiative for the events I've described lay rather with imperialism itself, which seized on the ideas and images of a moribund but romantically appealing institution and exploited them as a package to serve its ends. Le Vigier's ideas were at the same time authentically crusading and the products of 19th century imperialism. His early projects related to French ambitions around Lake Tanganyika, which collapsed in the chaos into which the region fell. His Institute of Armed Brothers was founded to take advantage of the French acquisition of most of the northwestern quarter of the continent. The plans and rhetoric associated with pseudo and para-crusading were similar amalgams of crusade and imperialist ideas. On the other hand, the recent history of crusade studies suggests that once scholars start looking for evidence in unexpected places, they find it. Has the 19th century even more to offer us? Of course, absolutely.
Professor Riley Smith will be happy to take questions, and there will be a reception in the Furnace Library after the questioning session is done. And we also wish to express our great, great gratitude to the staff of the library, both the sixth floor and the general staff of the library. It's been a marvelous support for us, and we couldn't have done it without them.
Someone.
How do you decide people feel a sense of empathy towards? Well, the term that I'm using it is in relation, of course, to crusaders. I mean, that is why I'm using it. I'm not applying it in general terms, nor am I treating it in senses of virtue. I've tried to come up with a term that describes the approach of a group of historians to motivation. I mean, insofar as one can generalize, one rejects the idea that profit, used in the broadest sense, is not the most significant thing, but something else is, which comprises ideas in the ideology. Emotions and so on, this is lumped in sensitivity. But it's, I know it's an extremely poor phrase, but it's the only one I've come up with, and if someone can suggest a better one, I'd be glad of it. The kind of founding father, if I can put it that way, of sensitivity, or at least the article which laid the basis for it, was written by Marcus Bull. And this particular article is greatly admired by a lot of young crusade historians who have been inspired by it. So in a sense, Marcus Bull is the father of sentient empathy. But I think I was a kind of sentient. Since then, Marcus Bull was a pupil of mine, and sort of claimed some kind of, perhaps rather arrogantly, I claimed some sort of part of this.
So happy to learn of this group, but so sad to learn how late they were to the party, because of course the slave trade had been outlawed in a lot of places by this time and had begun to wind down anyway. And
in Africa it was ferocious, and there was a real problem in Africa up to the end of the 19th century. The original Le Vigier's original obsession, well, he had two obsessions. One was his mission, of course, conversion of the Africans. And he was the person who believed very strongly that the Africans could convert Africans. Although he was typically imperialist in that he had very superior views of his own position and so on, his idea was to take Africans, train them as doctors, and said send them back to Africa. That was number one. But that was being, in his view, that all that work was nullified by slavery. And the other thing that worried him
were the activities of the Belgians in the Congo. But interestingly enough, it was not so much the cruelty of the Belgians, although he may have heard of that. It was the advance of Protestantism under Belgian aegis up the River Congo. That was worrying him. And so his one of his earliest ideas was the establishment of an indigenous African Catholic state, which would be a kind of centre for the escaped slaves, but also a block on Belgian advance. And when that collapsed, he then thought, well, the Order of Malta, it's now not called the Order of State, not the Malta and so on, use the Order of Malta. But A, the Grand Master of the Order of Malta, who was quite glad to turn it down, much to his rage, A, the Order of Malta had renounced military activities now to engage simply in KFC, and B, I really do think that engaging in another 30 years war in Africa against the Protestants was hardly what it was going to be. So that all collapsed. Those schemes he had for that part of what was now in the East Congo collapsed. But almost precisely as that collapsed, then there came this chance with the French acquisition, the Treaty of 1890 between the French and the British, allowing more French more or less free hand in most of all Northwest Africa, gave him a chance to switch his operations there. But there was still a problem with slavery, at least he perceived, and others perceived it too. And Biskra, this community, first community, the house was bought for him by the French anti-slavery society. He actually came to London, you know, and lectured in the Prince's Hall in Piccadilly. The English anti-slavery society was quite familiar. And Cardinal Manning was there, and Anglican bishops and everything. And he called them for a crusade against slavery in Africa. He wanted it. At that point, he was not being visited. He was not talking about establishment of orders of a state or military order. He actually wanted a crusade. That's more than that.
So I was wondering how you would respond to arguments from scholars like Hyerman, who basically assume that the categories are more semantic and not necessarily useful in describing crusades.
I think there is a case for saying that. I noticed that in Tarman has written three histories of crusades in 2 years, and they're all pluralist. And in the end, whatever you say, I mean, I think that these things are not in themselves. I think in the end, you can't come up with a single conception, single model. But I think nevertheless that so long as you're fairly relaxed about it, and don't get too uptight about pluralism. I mean, pluralism has actually expanded the subject and benefited the subject. But of course, all these are weak. And there is a case for saying, I think, is that one should just not try and define what crusading is. And I say that because people at the time knew what crusades were. I mean, they could identify crusaders. And this was because if you were a crusader, there were certain legal privileges and so on. I mean, at a time when the law courts and so on are developing in Europe, this was an important issue. And if they had no difficulty in recognising what a crusader was, then I think we have an obligation actually to try and get into their heads in that respect. But so long as we don't get to, what ex-President Clinton say, which you know, as long as we don't get too angry, too uptight about it.
Come to that question in a minute, and then I'm curious, in the pluralist scheme, you see a place, this requires the ethos for people, I guess, or even like the Jesuits, or even if they weren't martial, in terms of sort of supernatural organization, in terms of the ethos, just in terms of the
yes, you mean, is there a comparison that can be made between those orders which were not and the military orders? Yes, of course there are. But the problem with the Jesuits is, however, the Jesuits established their own model of slavery. It's called Paraguay, wasn't it? I mean, or at least there was this theocratic, this what we now call Paraguay. So there are ecclesiastical states other than the military order states of Prussia, Rhodes, and Malta, the papal patrimony in Italy and on the east bank of the Rhone. The Jesuit states in South America and so on, which have parallels, plus the employment, of course, desperate employment of the force. But the Jesuits are never a military order because the brothers themselves, the members of the order themselves, do not fight. What makes a military order is that members of the order themselves are like, in canon law terms, like all other religious, with that one exception: they have the right to bear arms. And there were a great many military orders in the Middle Ages. There are actually only two left now. The Order of Malta, which is still a very, now doesn't bear arms, but is still technically a military order. And the other one is the Teutonic Order, which is now an order of priests, and has no lay brothers at all, just but the Grand Master of the Teutonic Order still has the right to make knight brothers, although he never exercised them. So these forms of the religious life do actually still exist, at least theoretically.
Can I talk about 20 years ago, I lived briefly in a house in London which belonged to the Society for the Ransom of Christian Prisoners,
yes,
of Barbary. They now, it still exists, and they now care for deserving old maids or something.
Yes, yes. And there are also the Redemptorists, there are the Trinitarians. There still exist these Catholic orders, religious orders, which were established to ransom prisoners.
Yes.
I'm a little bit puzzled by what has been known in Jewish studies for a while, namely the abundant so-called lacrimose attitude to,
yes,
Jewish history, especially of course to the Ashkenaz Muslims.
Yes.
In fact, it reached the stage, the Ronnie Andrew obviously deals with,
yes,
settlements and so forth, but if those who analyze the Hebrew Chronicles,
yes,
already point out to rhetoric and so forth. But I would appreciate, how would you explain what I regard? Why is it that in order to qualify as a crusade, you actually have to engage in killing your neighbors? Which is this way when I read those
comments. They are not, crusaders are not entitled to kill innocent people who are absolutely there. The massacres that took place, and they took place in fact before every crusade to the east in the 12th. Were the fact that the church, or rather the preachers, were preaching in a way which led to a lack of control. Basically, the problem every crusade preacher faced was getting recruits. Crusading was not a pleasant thing to do. It was dangerous, it was expensive, extremely expensive. An expensive one, it was inconvenient, and you'd be away for a long time. So preachers had to set out to whip up feelings to such a point that people would do what actually did not come natural to many people, which was that they would be spontaneous. Spontaneity was not a mind. You know, if the head of the family said, you marry so-and-so, you do. You go to a religious house, you did. But what the preachers had to do was to get the situation, and they did it in ways which would be entirely familiar to us now. We know exactly what we did. The papal letter would be read out in translation. The preacher would then preach his sermon using various audiovisual aids, such as the backdrop of Muslims desecrating the Holy Sepulchre and indemnity. At the end of his preaching, his sermon, he was supposed to give what was called an invitatio, which was a highly emotional appeal. At that point, a choir would start singing. And then, just as, let's say, a Billy Graham thing, people would stand up, you see, and come forward. And when they came forward, there was a pile of made up crosses. Once they made a vow, and the vow was public, clearly, finally, and it's marked by the cross. Now, in order to get people into that state, preachers would play on popular concerns, like vengeance. Christ, your brother, your father, has been driven from his household. Your Christian brothers and sisters are being massacred, are being persecuted. What then tended to happen was that, and this is where things, at least in the early stages, got out of hand. When people said to themselves, or said amongst themselves, we have been called upon to march 2,000 miles to avenge an injury to Christ, when here are people who are the descendants of those who crucified him, why aren't we being called upon to take vengeance on them? So the massacres were consistently disapproved of by the church, and vast attempt, tremendous attempts were made to stop. The fact is, the very nature of crusading, the fact that there could be no crusade without crusaders, meant that the Pope, the bishops, and everyone were dependent upon the people. And to get the people involved, they had to arouse the people. And once the people were aroused, then the shepherds were training up the flocks of Ramah. So it was no part of a crusade. I mean, it was not, it was not any part of a crusade to persecute your Jewish neighbours. But that happened. And it did happen. And this is what I find so... I don't have very much sympathy with the sort of Muslims' complaints. It was getting as good as they went off there. I don't even have as much sympathy as I fact might ought to have the Greeks who are brilliant. I have the utmost sympathy for the Jews. I think the Jews of all people have got the cause of complaint. And that is what makes what is happening now in Israel so extraordinary. I first went to Israel in 1962 when I was sent to research to be supervised by Joshua Pratt for 3 months in Jerusalem. If a man dressed in crusader armour had ridden a horse up and down the streets of West Jerusalem, he would have been pelted with vegetables or something harder. In 1999, when the Israel Museum were putting on an exhibition on Kingdom of Jerusalem, there was a man in crusader armour parading up and down, and no one paid the slightest attention to
I think we could keep Professor Rice in here forever, but we may not want to do that, and talking to him during the reception might be a better idea, and give us access to this stuff before the night's over. So we thank you again.